Well, thank you very much. It's great to be back. The reason for my absence since 1997 was because I was just absent from every place. I was busy writing that thing that is going around the room. And so I'll be visible again from now on. It is really very nice to be back here. I find this such a pure place and such a place that we can sort of do bicycle riding in better weather, swimming, and learning physics all the time. If you want to ask about the avian flu, I'll tell you about that at the end. There's very little. Just keep your good habits going. You're not doing anything really wrong. The reason I chose the kind of title I did was, first of all, he didn't like the first title I gave him. Tony said, find something more interesting. So I went to my list of titles for this book that the publisher had rejected, and I figured out one that would never be on a book title, and that's this idea here. And the idea I'm trying to convey, though, is that Van der Waals forces are viewed so differently by so many different people, and they have so many peculiar practices in them, peculiar to different disciplines, that when we learn about them, we really want to learn about them in the totality. I would like to think of it as the physicists are doing the best job of thinking about the quantum mechanics and thinking about charge fluctuation forces in the best possible way. But people in subjects such as chemical engineering are doing so much work on aerosols, colloids, all kinds of practical systems where these forces are in fact very powerful. They're not just the small corrections to the ideal gas law. And a huge amount of very good physics resides in those applications, or even we could say those instances. We don't even have to think of it in a purely practical way. So in fact, I like to think of this subject in two ways. One is the physics of it, which is really the fun stuff, and where you see it, which has a lot of fun and also challenging learning things to go with it. And I want to start basically with the idea that it's been a very long learning adventure for me. I learned how to turn this off, and now I have the adventure of turning it on. This work really spans over a period of about 35 years of my life, when I've had off and on associations with many people whose names will show up here. And the point I'm making in this opening slide is it's a work of an evolution of work, starting with Barry Ninnemann in the late 1960s, and even right now with people, some of you right here in the room, where we're doing many modern applications. The second point, already we heard what's going on. All of the work I've done has been at the National Institutes of Health, which has this wonderful, healthy idea about science, that if you can support physics and do things in physics, they really immediately feed into good consequences for the human race. And I'm going to kind of give a commercial message about halfway through, because I think there are a lot of opportunities for physicists, in even more than we know about now, in biological connections, and I hope to see some examples of them given here. I also put the website, because that's what I'd like you to see as the background for this, and there's a lot more information there. Now, you say Van der Waals to most people, and they think of the thing on the right. They say, well, there was Boyle's law, we learned about entropy from that, and then there was Van der Waals gases, which taught us about interactions and steric potentials, things like this. It was a long time going between those two, between the time when we could just think of the idea of pure entropy and think of the idea of entropy as modified by interaction. And the Van der Waals gas equation became this sort of a test of what we thought about as forces. In fact, the title of Van der Waals' thesis, if I understand enough Dutch, was the continuity of the gas and the liquid states. Because as we know, we teach ourselves that it was only when you have interactions that gases can create condensed phases. And more than that, we talk about Van der Waals forces in these situations. They're really far more important in the condensed states, where they're made possible by the virtue of interaction. I will start, though, with this very baby idea of what we think about a Van der Waals force. It's what I call the charge-based idea of interaction. Neutral bodies are yet made up of plus and minuses, and we have learned, again, at a fairly early age, there's a good example right there, that there are fluctuations in the positions of charges, and that in those fluctuations there are transient dipoles, and those transient dipoles, am I blocking your view, sir? Those transient dipoles, in fact, create the forces of inverse six power forces that we all talk about. There's actually a very nice variety of these. There are correlations and orientations of permanent dipoles. There are induced dipoles from non-polarizable but non-polar materials, feeling polar molecules, and in fact, then there are the famous London forces, where spontaneous fluctuations simply create dipoles on each other and create these long-range, well, not so long-range, power law interactions. Now, the transition to this to interesting materials took two turns. One of them was this. In the 1930s, the idea was, if I really want to look at large condensed materials, I'll simply make believe that the pieces of those materials interact with each other as though they were part a gas. And this idea of adding up pairwise summation was first done by Deryagin in 1934, and then it was done much more popular, accessible way by Hamacher in 1937. And the idea is you can change the power of the interaction simply by the way you add things up. What was an inverse six power interaction now becomes an inverse square interaction if, as in this case, it's between two half spaces, two semi-infinite half spaces. And immediately this idea grabbed on in colloid science, where you realize suddenly if you have suspensions of finite-sized particles, if you have particles whose separation is small compared to their size, these interactions can now be much more important than they were just tiny corrections to the gas equation. This is one tradition, but there was something else that happened that changed the whole way the human race thought about these things. And that was actually going back to the black box of Max Planck in the 1890s. Those fluctuations, those little things that the kid is showing you with his hands there, are setting up electric fields. And if you can step back and look at what's going on from the so-called field point of view, think in terms of all the electric fields that could be occurring when you have a particular configuration of boundaries, you can begin to look at the energy of the field as the source of the energy of interaction. We learn about it from the hollow black box and the specific heat of exciting modes in a black box. But then the really brilliant, great next step came in the 1940s when the great Dutch physicist Casimir realized if you deform this box, if you make it so that it's two large flat walls and you look at the allowed modes as a function of separation, suddenly you're able to see how there's an energy of interaction simply by what's allowed to occur between surfaces. Just from an existence thing like this. That idea, I'll come back to in a minute, got generalized in the next 10 years where the Russians, Lifshitz, Jalasinski, Petayevsky, introduced material properties to the walls, introduced a real medium, and translated this whole field point of view into a way of coupling electromagnetic fluctuations to material properties. And that was really the takeoff of this subject. So let's just give credit here. One is Mr. van der Waals, whom we know from way back. By the way, I spent more time on this slide trying to figure out if there are two M's in Dramatis or one M than I think the rest of it. But this is the definitive spelling of Dramatis. The equation of state of Joel Leibowitz said van der Waals' equation of state was so successful that it stopped the development of liquid theory for 100 years. It's problems with success. It just worked so magnificently well. But the one I like most of all is by Casimir himself. He describes it in a memoir he wrote, that he said he was thinking about this problem of how to handle electromagnetic fluctuations. He said, I mentioned my results to Niels Bohr during a walk. That is nice, he said. That is something new. By the way, I'm following the modern tradition that physicists aren't able to read, so I'm reading it to you. And he mumbled about zero-point energy. That was all, but in retrospect, I have to admit that I owe much to this remark. So what was going on was, Bohr was pointing out that even having the degree of freedom, even having a boundary condition constraining degrees of freedom, allowed electromagnetic fluctuations that were an important part of an energy of an interacting system where you changed those boundaries. The generalization of it by Lipschitz, Ginzburg wrote many years later, in fact, it was well after we got our work going on it, he said the calculations were so cumbersome they were not even reproduced in the relevant Landau and Lipschitz volume, where, as a rule, all important calculations are given. And you may remember, it was so cut a little bit of a thing there, but you remember that it was in the Electrodynamics of Continuous Media book. There was a whole section on these interactions, but in fact, they were just given. It is unusual that way. So let's go back just a step here and ask ourselves, stand outside, inside. We're usually thinking the way the kid was about the charges fluctuating, but now imagine a boundary condition, a constraint that says, I'm going to put two metal plates with a finite separation such that, as we learn as kids in learning blackbody radiation, only certain modes are allowed. Then you immediately see where there's no constraint, there are many, many more fluctuations. The electromagnetic stress is necessarily going to be greater, just as a counting game, than what's existing between the plates. This is exactly the idea of why it creates an attraction. You're just feeling this magnificent thought, the cosmos is pushing in on you with all these zero-point fluctuations, and you're seeing it in a force between two objects. So the picture that goes with this, and I'm going to come back to it in a way at the very, very end, because there are cases where you actually see these things, and you can see it in the harbor here. This idea that if you have anything that changes random fluctuations, there's basically a momentum acting on it if there's an imbalance on what's going on the two sides. And we can go down to the harbor and we see they're putting these rubber barriers and whatnot to keep the boats from clanking together. It's exactly the same idea, that if you have randomness and a little less agitation, there's immediately a net force. And that's what anybody will do. If I have these two bodies, and I'm in this vacuum infinity here, and I'm changing this separation, basically what I'm saying is there's not so much stuff able to happen here, and all those waves are coming down and it's creating, you could say, an attractive force, or you could say it's reacting to the stress that we've been suffering from all our lives and never really thought about it. So this idea I want you to keep in mind, because it's basically the whole history of the subject changed perspectives now. Everything became real materials, real abilities to stop waves passing through, susceptibilities, permittivities show up in this nice idea. But what we're talking about is electromagnetic permittivities and susceptibilities that create forces. So this is, of course, New York Times. Unfortunately, Casimir had this in 1946, but the New York Times sort of caught up with it in 1997 and pointed out that there is the power of nothing, the force of this quantum foam. It's the same idea as the boats. Now, this is for the graduate students in the room. Before all of this, before any of this, there was a graduate student who went on to some fame. He got himself a postage stamp, finally, who was writing in his thesis thinking about the recent formulation of electromagnetic theory with those big names up there, Hertz, Maxwell. And this is the last thing I'm going to read to you of this length, but it's just so amazing that a kid 25 or so years old had this insight, and he basically was ahead of the whole rest of the human race by about 50 years. He said, hidden in Hertz's research in the interpretation of light oscillations as electromagnetic processes is still another undealt with question. The source of the light emission of the processes which take place in the molecular vibrator, and remember, people were just learning about molecules at that time, at the source of light emission. At the time when they give up light energy to the surrounding space. Maybe you should read this to yourself. Such a problem leads us to one of the most complicated problems of modern physics, the study of molecular forces. Adopting the view of the electromagnetic theory of light, this is sort of the latest word in those days, we must state that between two radiating molecules, just as between two vibrators in which electromagnetic oscillations are excited, there exist ponderomotive forces. That's a Landau and Lipschitz word, right? Ponderomotive means body forces. By the way, is that word used in teaching kids these days? In plasma physics, they still say, okay, good, yeah. No, I just saw it in Land on Lizards. They are due to the electromagnetic interaction between the alternating electric current and the molecules. We must therefore state that there exist between the molecules in such a case molecular forces whose cause is inseparably linked with the radiation processes. And then he says this great, great thing. Of greatest interest and greatest difficulty is the case of a physical body in which many molecules act simultaneously on one another, the vibrations of the latter not being independent due to their close proximity. He saw the many-body problem in terms of the fields. And that's basically what happens when you take all of this and you fast forward. And the way I understand the story, Lebedev adopted Deryagin, who was his stepson. And Deryagin got into colloid science, and Deryagin's early papers, I already cited one of them, used this pairwise summation idea. And I think what happened was that Deryagin got Lipschitz to work on this problem. And there's a direct continuity from that graduate student all the way up to what we're talking about today. It's almost like a family relation. So this is the key result. I'm going to show this a few times. I'm going to come back to it because I want you to get a little bit of intuition when I go through a lot of examples and how we as a human race since then have learned to harness all this. So the first idea is that the interaction goes basically in the language of an inverse square, in the language of an inverse square potential, and that the coefficient that governs it depends on differences in polarizability, susceptibility. Spontaneous fluctuations are related to the polarizability of a material. And differences in polarizability are what electromagnetically define an interface so that an energy will depend on a separation. So you could say if you had stuff A and stuff M the same, you wouldn't have anything interesting going on. But if you had differences, you'd get attractions if A and B both had polarizabilities greater than the medium. And you would have repulsions. This is really interesting. You would have repulsions if material A were, say, air, and material M were just some liquid that was flowing on a surface. So that interaction would be such as to want to thicken this layer if A were not a polarizable material on its own. So what one is looking at, unlike electrostatics, this is far more interesting than electrostatics, is looking at the response of materials over the entire frequency spectrum. Any possible motion becomes interesting. Any possible fluctuation becomes interesting. And in fact, the sampling frequencies are these Matsubara frequencies. I'll say it in a minute, but basically they're the photons. It's multiples of photon energy in KT units. So we want to look at the entire frequency spectrum. That now it preserves this inverse square dependence that I showed you even from that pairwise summation language. Differences create forces, and it's the usual way to think, this is going to be very important in a little while, that the interfaces have been mathematically sharp for reasons of convenience. Of course, there's something wrong. You can't have something going to infinity at contact when you just have two materials touching each other. Now, just a word about where these epsilons came from. We were hung up as humans for a very long time not knowing how to find the epsilons that fed this formula. And I'll just remind you of several really, really neat things about materials, sort of unavoidable properties of matter. One is a traditional idea from the 1920s that if you have a resistance in a material, there will be current fluctuations simply due to thermal disturbance. And that matured very nicely in 20, 30 years that followed that to the idea that current fluctuations could occur anytime you had a dissipative part to the total response. So we use the language of radial frequencies, omega, and susceptibility with a real part, an elastic part, and a dissipative part. It's the dissipative part, analogous to the resistance, that creates the possibility of current fluctuations or charge fluctuations. And now the really neat thing in this theory is that we can transform the measured absorption spectrum, basically this epsilon double prime here, into a form that actually feeds into the Lipschitz result. What we're always talking about are not normal oscillatory frequencies, but so-called exponential or imaginary frequencies. It's as if the property that counted was the exponential regression from a fluctuation, rather than thinking of things as a coupled oscillator. And what this allows you to do is go through this transform to make a much smoother function of a frequency than would ordinarily be the case with epsilons. Now, does anybody besides Dan Hone know, besides calling this a Kramers-Kronig relation, what's the other word for this thing? I was absolutely astounded and impressed when he knew what the other name, I haven't used it for years. What's the name of that transform? Do people use that routinely? Sorry? Good. Okay. I guess I'm in the right crowd. Okay, I wouldn't say that in the Institute of Child Health. Okay. So is that is it commonplace here? I don't know. Don't need to embarrass Dan. So the idea is that you can sample a material at all these frequencies and then create interactions or see what interactions there are. What can you do with it? This is stuff Barry Ninneman, David Ginschel, and I did many years ago. The Hilbert transform. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I felt so embarrassed asking you the question. I thought I was asking a totally inane question. Everybody knows that. I learned it from Barry Ninneman, so I had to wait a while to learn it too. So, what are the magnitudes of those coefficients? Typically, they're named after Mr. Hamacher. They run anywhere from about kT to maybe 100 kT. Depending on whether there's a medium in between or a vacuum in between, whether they have a highly polar material or not. And basically what it says is that you'll get, and I'm not going to give a lot of examples of this, so I'll just say it because it's a super nice thing to remember. If interacting bodies are large compared to their separation, with these typical coefficients, the energies of interaction are comparable to or greater than thermal energy. So it immediately means they're thermally important, say for condensation features and things like that, under those conditions. So just one last glimpse at this before I jump into a set of examples that have occurred over the last 50 years validating this. My plan now, I don't know what my time is going, but I think I've got exactly on schedule. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to show you about 10 or 12 examples from the 1950s till now, where this Gall got on really good ground. We began to see how it really works. Then I'm going to show you two examples of really unexpected occurrences of these things, one from an engineering perspective and the other from the perspective of what our biomachines program is talking about, properties of solution that modify these interactions. And then I'm going to close with some non-electromagnetic examples to see how generalized these ideas of fluctuation can be. Are there questions by now? This is a terribly tame audience. I don't know. Is it after lunch or is it? The lights are too low? What's going on? I'm not throwing candy. Yeah, it's probably. Should I have brought candy? I have my reputation. Everybody happy with this so far? I mean, you're listening. You're all great. I'm not saying anything. No complaints. It's good. I won't tell you how many of you are asleep, but it's very few. It's statistically improbable. Okay. Anyway, so over these 50 years, there have been a remarkable number of tests of this. The problem is the following, and I think you know it already. If I tell you that all frequencies count, then you tell me, hey, buddy, you mean to say you've measured absorption spectra at all those frequencies? And that's been really the problem, that we haven't really had good spectroscopy to go with the measurements that would be real tests as opposed to measurements that say it's a valid number. But I'll go fairly quickly through this. I expected more questions, so I was going to say at this stage, please let me go fast, but that's okay. So the first measurements of these things were by the Russians, as one would expect, in the 1950s, actually, where they made force measurements between glass courts, things like this. And it was Beryagin and his buddies who were doing this. And I read that first reference with some nostalgia because I think I just graduated from college then, and I read this article in Scientific American, and I thought, gee, that's a really neat thing. And it was the first time that people really had measured forces between lens size objects and got clear indication of strong forces. What well known is the series of measurements between mica surfaces by Israel Ashvili, Tabor, and all their people, and that's summarized in a 1973 article. The one that set Barry Ninnem and me going was a measurement by Dennis Hayden and Janet Taylor in 1968, where they noticed that if they had a membrane of lipids in water, that there'd be drops of hydrocarbon attached, and in the microscope they could see these blemishes. And they were actually able to measure contact angles and infer that there was an extra attractive component across the membrane, just at the point where the membrane thinned down to its normal value. And from this angle, they were able to work out this van der Waals component. It was really quite a striking measurement of a very, very tiny energy. It's about 0.02 dynes per centimeter squared, for people who are old enough to know dynes per centimeter squared. And I think that was the first time that people actually found these things going on in condensed media. In fact, these forces are rather powerful in forming these films. As you know, if you blow a bubble or something, water has to drain out. Well, in this case, you could actually see the extra force, not just of drainage, but these electromagnetic forces actually pulling through. This one was a magnificent measurement by the lab of Polycarp Kush and Raskin and Shi were graduate students who were able to take a gold cylinder and shine an atomic beam of alkali ions, or atoms I should say, across. And from the deflection, this atomic beam measurement, they were able to infer the relation between the impact parameter, the beam, how far away the particle was from the surface, and the deflection. They were able to work out the profile of deflection, and that between 100 and 1,000 angstroms of distance, they were able to create a force-distance curve. And I was able to work with Arnold Shi to compare that with a calculation fairly successfully. This is my favorite one, and this is why I said about remember that the left-hand medium could be a vacuum or air. This is Anderson and Sibisky in the early 70s, took liquid helium and put it in a wall of ceramic. And they found that it's a great crawling the walls experiment. You can see the profile of the measurement. Beryagin had actually done a measurement like this, but they didn't have quite as good spectra. This was the first time, I think, where they knew all the spectra of the materials. And they were able to compare the profile of the helium being attracted to the wall of the vessel with the calculation just based on spectra, just using the Lifshitz theory. Oops. This is a measurement by Evan Evans and Peter Rand, and we worked on this together, where he holds two vesicles together and he finds that suddenly they flatten very hard, and then from the contact angle again able to measure the force of attraction of flattening. And again, it worked out very nicely compared to experiment. Same idea here, looking at those bilayers as Peter Rand and I had been doing, and putting them also on mica surfaces and able to reconcile the correction for whether the mica is there or not and the lipid is hanging free or not. And we got a very nice correspondence between the surface force measurements and the suspended bilayers. Gold particles near a surface, you can measure the distribution, just use Boltzmann's law and you can actually work out a force-distance relation. Aerosol aggregation, you're beginning to see that they're coming into some fairly fancy systems here. And finally, a recent set of measurements. Physicists still like Casimir, I guess it's sort of a tradition. And these are interactions, various labs, Bell Labs, and several other places where they've been measuring with force balances the interactions of metals with surfaces. And then, of course, the one that everybody knows about, somebody actually calculated the force of pulling a hair of a gecko from a wall and convinced himself that it was enough of a force to be called a van der Waals force, so these characters can crawl all over the ceiling. And it's a very interesting process how it works, because it's like peeling scotch tape in microscopic ways in order to be able to pull your foot off and take the next step. But if this is true, then of course then every kind of bug you can think about has this possibility going for it. Oops. So now I want to really slow down and talk about two kinds of things that will, I think, guide us in learning experiments. This is a biomachines program, and we're thinking a lot about molecular forces. We just heard a nice talk on the forces in proteins and DNA and all these questions about what determines conformation and the need to have better force. This is a couple of examples of what I would like to think are going to be paths of learning for all of us. Now, I'll remind you again, the same picture should be absolutely boring to you by now. Differences determine forces. Forces across media, where there are sharp interfaces, create power laws. But in fact, you can do a lot better than that. You can, for example, as Rudy Podgornik and I have been doing the last couple of years, basically generalize that whole thing. So you can have any profile of polarizability, continuous, discontinuous steps, and get, yeah, a question, finally, yeah. 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 Yes. 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 Right. Absolutely, yes. Yes. Absolutely, yes. Yes. That's exactly what happens. And I'll say it exactly like this. Two flats, that's what we've been talking about. And I was going to make a couple comments just like this, so I'll do them now. If you have two curved surfaces, of course, then there's a regime when they're very, very close, and they almost look like bits of flat surfaces to each other. Der Jagen, in fact, in that 1934 article, saw that already, and he showed that what we now call the Der Jagen transform. So you can go between the formula for flat surfaces and curved surfaces. At the other extreme, I'll come back to the middle in a second. At the other extreme, of course, particles are looking like the point particles that we talked about at the start. The formulae, there are several ways to bridge that intermediate going between the inverse square of the long distance and the short part. In between, usually, you can get away with an expansion in terms of differences in the epsilons, because you can sort of think of it as a kind of a reflection thing. Otherwise, there are interpolation formulae that are not that good, but the deviation isn't that large from the extrapolated between them. You know, if you make sure I talk fast enough, you're going to be very happy. Okay. I'm going to keep that for a surprise. That's too good a story. Okay. Yeah. Other questions? Other comments? Oops. In fact, this begins to be coming to this point. If you have soft interfaces, if you have interfaces where there's a gradient in the dielectric process probabilities, you even lose the power law dependence. This is a formula where you just have exponential variation. So you begin to see that the range is depending on the form of the dielectric dispersion in space. And even now, what it's able to do is to look at a medium where you're actually squeezing out a solution in between and see it go from a contact of a continuous medium to very far apart, where the step looks almost like the Lipschitz case again. Why would one want to do that? Well, I was doing modern research. I learned how to do that. You go www.google.com and you type van der Waals. And I had the temerity to put my name next to it. And I came up with a website of Roger French at the DuPont Labs. where he had, I drew a bad picture and it looked even worse on the screen, but I kept it just for historical purity. But basically, he took one of these formulas that George Weiss and I had derived some time ago, and he was using it to infer what kind of interactions would occur when you had graded interfaces, inhomogeneous graded interfaces. In this particular case, he was taking a quadratic dispersion. Why was he doing this? This is, you have to go to the next screen, right? Roger works at the DuPont labs, and he invented a Eales machine, an electron energy loss machine, that can scan across an interface, basically measure the absorption spectrum across the space between two materials. He's able to create a statement of the epsilon as it varies with separation. And it's a continuous function, as we would expect it to be. Why was he doing this? Because he was making thin film resistors. He was trying to develop a way to make thin film resistors in computers. If you have insulating blobs and you want to control conductance, what you do is you want to make a very small conductance path in the conducting medium in between. And what he was doing was calculating what the van der Waals forces would be in different conducting media with insulating blobs, and then if you heat, how you could create thin film resistors by heating for different lengths of time. The insulators would come together under van der Waals forces, but van der Waals forces in this interesting way of having a spatially varying response, and in that way create a practical device. And this is the kind of thing that he was looking at, where you would watch, if I can see this with you, you'd have aluminum oxide with calcium doped silica in between, and a segregation even of the calcium near the interface, and you could infer a force of attraction from the measured spectra. So this was actually creating an industrial process based on this quantum electrodynamic view of materials. And basically, that, I asked him, I met him. This is, by the way, writing a book is an absolutely great way to make friends. I notice you keep finding names and you call people up and you say, I really liked your work. And then immediately you're off to the races. And so this was a great, great thing with Roger. I found out that they use this in the Pentium 3 already. There are about 300 of these van der Waals force-based thin chip resistors in every Pentium chip or every laptop computer. And this is basically a form of industrial design now to use van der Waals forces to create electronic devices. And I was going to sort of just take a little bit of a riff at this point, because what I think we as physicists forget is the enormous amount of wealth that's getting created by these geeky things that we're doing. That, in fact, who would have thought that this Russian kid who had this idea so long ago would go on to create a science that would actually create a thin film resistor process? And it's an enormous amount of wealth production that comes out of the physics that we're doing. And just mentioning this as one example, I could think at the NIH, the number of neat things that have come out as devices that have been developed in labs. And I hear all these deep discussions about how do we get more money? And I think the good way to do it is to start making examples of all these things that fell out that created wealth that was allowing us to learn more. You know, I don't like a quiet audience, not this quiet. Are you really that asleep? I mean, your eyes are all open. You're smiling at the right moments. It's very nice. I like all of you. But you really have no questions? I am incapable of giving a perfect talk, so I just, unlike the rest of you, maybe. So please ask. It could be just the hour. It's just a great time to sleep, I admit. But you're not sleeping. You're all awake. It's great. So I wanted just to give this idea that this has pervaded our life now. All these abstract ideas have now come to this point where we are really able to see these things working for us. The second example, Roger being a very idealistic guy and working with Linda Neuer, the lady who does his software, and working for DuPont, who's enormously happy for all the money he made for DuPont, has license to do a lot of the basic research connected with this. And one of the really neat things that came out after we made friends was that Lynn is providing free software where we're progressively putting all the hundreds of formulas that are in this book that are floating around the room, so we can make available to everybody the capacity to compute. Okay? And at the same time, we've teamed up with them, and I'm going to give an example of one such teaming up, where we're beginning to use their spectroscopy for getting better spectra for interesting materials, so that we can really get going to harness the theory that I've been telling you about. And this is, if you want to, give you enough time to copy that down. It's basically a freeware, and I think that really will liberate people to start using the interactions. Aren't scientists idealistic people? Isn't it great to be associated with such a bunch? Nobody's interested in money, credit, nothing like that. So the next thing is an example of, if you have a medium and you change its polarization properties the way you used to do when your mother got angry at you because you were putting salt in the water at the table and you watched all those neat things happening. So you are actually changing those properties that control interactions. And the example I'm going to give is lipid bilayers, which I've mentioned in another connection a little while ago. Basically, in this case, this is the work of Horia Petrucci and Daniel Harris and Itamar Kimchi in our lab, and John Nagel and Stephanie Nagel. If you take lipid bilayers that are electrically neutral, the green stuff is neutral, and you suspend them in distilled water, what you find is they form a multi-layer stack that's so well organized that when you shoot x-rays at them, you get very nice x-ray pictures, and you can measure the distances between them. You can get, in fact, what we've been doing for many years, measuring the forces between these layers by another technique. Now, what was done here was simply to say, let me put salt in the water. Just put salt in the water. These are neutral layers. What would happen putting salt with most things? You don't really think about it that much. But in this particular case, as soon as, salt, the button's right. We put sodium or potassium chloride or bromide and looked to see how much those layers are swelling. What we've learned from years of working on the forces in these systems is that first ordering is due to attraction. That's basically van der Waals attraction, and this is going to be more evidence of it. And as we push them together, we find that there are solvation forces that keep them apart. In this case, what happened was when Horia put a little bit of salt in the water with the bromide, there was a big jump apart, and it plateaued. With the chloride, there was a little bit slower rise. But in both cases, the attractive forces that were maintaining that regime were very clearly weakened. I don't have a picture here. I took it out. But at the same time, the x-ray picture got really blurry, too. It was as if they were sitting in a much weaker minimum. And what we have inferred from this after a lot of work, and the paper just came out, actually, this past week, is three kinds of effects that go with van der Waals forces. One of them is simple. One of them is that example I gave before when at the very beginning I said if I have A and B and M, let's say A and B be the same, and I add some solute to the medium, the difference in the dielectric responses is getting smaller, and it simply weakens those interactions because we've lessened that essential difference that creates the forces. That one works very nicely. Bromide being more polar than chloride has a bigger effect on the index of refraction, and everything checks out very nicely. At the same time, there's clearly a difference here that goes different from what we thought. And that takes a little bit of talking. I took out the slides because I thought it'd be a little bit too much, but I'll say it in words. You remember water has a dielectric constant of 80 way down here at zero frequency, constant. And hydrocarbon has a dielectric constant of about 2. So that difference over sums is huge at the very low frequency, at zero frequency for water. So big is the difference that, in fact, if you have ions in the water, these huge fluctuations that are caused, enabled by the high polarizability of water, are screened as if it's an electrical double layer. The salt has time to follow the fluctuations of the water at a very low frequency, and there's a screening where you have a correlation of a potential here and a potential there. Now what you have is a Debye-Huckel kind of screening that cuts the correlation that creates this attraction. And it's extraordinarily sensitive to the salt concentration. That's the first thing, and that's something Barry and I found some years ago. And then there's another point, and Barry's been pushing this for a while, and I think it's an absolutely great idea. If I have a hydrocarbon water interface, there are lots and lots of things that are going on, but one of them is that optical frequencies, the hydrocarbon is actually more polar than water. Index of refraction of water is less than hydrocarbon. If I have something that raises the index of refraction, like a bromide ion, there's actually a finite attraction at the high frequency of the ions for the hydrocarbon interface, so that it's actually an extra attraction that, in effect, believe it or not, even though these are neutral bilayers, charges the bilayer. It creates such an imbalance that you can go in and you can measure the force, and you can see how the van der Waals force of attraction to a hydrocarbon actually creates an extra attractive strength. So there are actually three things going on that are totally new behavior for how we think about salts. And I could give you many, many examples of different ions acting in ways that are completely and qualitatively different from what we've traditionally thought about salt and salt solutions. And they're based on van der Waals interactions. Now, who asked me about close interactions, right? Okay, so I'm writing this book, and there's this guy named Kevin Cahill who's on sabbatical with us, and he comes into my room, I'm busy working, and he says, Adrian, has anybody thought about first order interactions? Well, I didn't tell you too much about that, but I'll tell you first, second order now. Second order interactions are what we've been talking about, where you have basically neutral objects, but there are fluctuations that create dipoles. There are mutual perturbations that create interactions. The stuff you learned about in high school when they first told you about van der Waals forces, second order. Zeroth order, of course, is just an isolated object. But what if you just said, look, I have a net neutral object and another net neutral object, and I get them close enough so they begin to see details in each other. Is the interaction still zero? It's a good question. So Kevin did this calculation. He got an answer that was as big as the London force between ions, noble gases. So, right. There is the dipole interaction. But if I just keep the original wave function and don't have any perturbation, I just do Coulomb's law. That's it. Okay? No dipole, just charge interaction. Just add up the charges on the two bodies. Just electrostatics, period. Okay. If they're spherically symmetrical objects, well, these guys, yeah, kryptons, say like that. Yeah, these are noble gases, yeah. Yeah, you're really getting hot now. Right. What's happening is you're just doing pure Coulomb on charge densities that extend in space. And we've been all brought up to think, forget it, because they die exponentially. I told Kevin I don't believe it. He went and did a double precision. He came back with the same answer. I told him, we'll ask Rudy. He likes Mathematica. Rudy did it on Mathematica. He got the same answer. So finally, I was desperate, and I pulled Landau and Lifshitz off the shelf. And I found this great, amazing footnote, as you often do in Landau and Lifshitz. It basically said, in their section on London forces, he said, this, of course, does not imply that the mean value of the interaction energy of the atoms is precisely zero. It diminishes exponentially with distance, i.e. more rapidly than any power, and hence each term of the expansion varies. But these are exponentials, and if you start talking about condensed media, these exponentials reach each other. And when you really do the work, which Kevin did, you find that you can work back. This is a little hard to read, and I apologize for it. You can take the plus symbols of the exact solutions with, I don't know, 40 terms and whatever in a careful calculation for two krypton atoms, and you can work backwards and see what kind of an interaction would fit, but this time you give yourself a really tough constraint. You say, I'm not going to cheat the way they do with Lennard-Jones 6-12 potentials and fit the base of the minimum and the position of the minimum and make believe I have a 6 potential driving it. I'm going to say, I'm going to pick those two constraints, but I'm going to make it end honestly. I'm going to make it the way London would have really wanted it. I want to have it that when they're far apart, I don't have a coefficient that's 2 to 6 times wrong, just because I made it fit the minimum in the condensed state. I'm going to make it go smoothly over. Well, there is a form that does that. We felt good about getting that. It deviates significantly from the 6-12 potential. And it also gives us a way of looking much more carefully now at what are the condensing forces. We have now a mathematically convenient form. I have found a sociological phenomenon I just do not understand. When I was, halfway through now, people were first doing computer simulations of molecular interactions, statistical mechanics of noble gases and all this kind of stuff. Numerical simulations were coming in, and people were using 6-12 potentials to talk about gas-liquid transitions and noble gases and whatnot. It all went on and on. Now we're in this morass of computer simulations that we know again and again don't even do more than draw pretty pictures for us in proteins. But now we have a chance to go back and examine with good computation, use real potentials to go re-examine liquid gas transitions. And I find virtually nobody interested in it. And I find it heartbreaking. Here, van der Waals, this poor guy, 18, whatever he was, says the continuity of the gas in the liquid state, and the human race, by common consent, has decided to ignore it. We're not using potentials that fit the gas in order to talk about liquids. It's as if that became passé, and I find that a little bit surprising. But if there are any volunteers here who'd like to think about this, I think there's a really good field of learning here just to check the foundations. And I think we're really learning now how much we need to improve our potentials for more interesting systems.
Can I ask what goes into this calculation? Are you assuming that the electronic configuration is frozen okay.
What goes into this? Come on, this is computers. We cheat. Okay? This one is simply saying, look, I take the squares, I take the pluses, the exact solution, I give it an honest London tail.
But what's the exact solution? Because no solution is going to be exact.
Right. So what I do is this is before your eyes, but I say, I'll try a Rydberg form and it works. Okay? Now I'll hand you that. The pluses. Well, now that was a total numeric solution with, 41 terms. It was the whole schmear. It was a total quantum mechanics. Absolutely. I mean, they just went crazy. Yeah. The whole stuff. That was really, you know, if you're really compulsive and you get off on it, that was it. Yeah. Right. So that was my third example. I was really shocked by that. I'm going to give two more slides. You don't have to sneak out. It's okay. Nobody noticed. It's all right. Where does it go from here in terms of other kinds of things that could be happening? One of the really sweet things is you meet lots of nice people like Dan Hone, and you find out they've been thinking for a long time about other systems where perturbations on surfaces create forces. And there are these so-called pseudo-Casimir effects, where you can begin to look to see what kind of interactions would occur when you deform pneumatic fields, for example. Or, in this case, back to the boats. This is a calculation. In fact, Phil did show up, so I can't make an insulting remark about him not being here. That, in fact, it's just this. If you have stiff rods in a fluctuating medium, it's the same idea again. If these guys can fluctuate, it creates attractive forces. It's the same idea because you've changed a material property, you've taken modes away, and you've been able to create the force that will squeeze out the limited modes in order to enjoy greater freedom outside. Yeah. You watch out, that guy's going to kiss you. You just watch out. I think the answer is yes. Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge subject, and he's been thinking about it for about 20 years, and it's yes, 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 okay. Right, great, great question. And okay, the very last slide. I did this, and I'm going to do it very quickly because I'm among people who know much more about this than I do, but there was a question in terms of even the radiation drag on an expanding universe. And we did a little calculation, mainly Funnick, Mercredichian, and Wayne Saslow, and Rudy Podgornik, where they, you could imagine if you have interaction between two reference frames, so that a particle that's moving fast in a field of light is coupling and feeling a drag. There's actually a viscous drag, linear in the velocity, and it has a very tiny effect. I think it changes the age of the universe by about, I don't know, 10 to the ninth years or something. It's really very small on the scale of things. But there is, in fact, a cosmological consequence. They don't laugh, Rudy. 10 to the ninth years, they don't think. There is a version of this where you're actually coupling material properties to radiation fields, and it's causing effectively drag on neutral objects just because of the expanding light. And you can use the same kinds of equations that I've been talking about. Thank you for listening. I knew you were awake. I hate to tell you, but you're one of the best behaved audiences I've ever seen. That's not a compliment. So please ask questions. Thank you. Yes, hi. Yeah.